Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Yud-Amud Aleph. We finished off yesterday with the machloki between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua as to what is the main source of water in the world. Rabbi Eliezer is of the opinion, kol olam kulo mimei okeanus ushoteh, that the waters derive from the oceans down below, and that's what provides all the rain and the sustenance of the world. Whereas Rabbi Yoshua is of a different opinion, that kol olam kulo mimei melyonim ushoteh, that the waters are stored up in the heavens above, and they provide the waters that rain upon us and bring water to the world. The question as to what is the source of the water in the world? Is it the water that's already here in the oceans, or is it the water from above the Rakia, that waters that sit up in the heavens? And the Gemara discussed different proofs. The last time we discussed was, who is this, like the statement of Rabbi Chanina, who says, Kones kened me'ayam notein b'otzerot t'mo'ot, mi garam lo tzerot shit malu bar, what causes all the silos to be filled with grains? T'mo'ot. The depths. That's like Rabbi Eliezer, who says that the water sources from the ground. What's Rabbi Yeshua going to do that? Rabbi Yeshua, how will be briyato shel olam? That was when the world was created. That was the situation where the whole world was covered in water, and then Hashem gathered them into a single location, into the oceans, in order to provide dry land around them. And that's what it means. It brought them or piled them up into otzerot. It's as if he brought them into silos, which are the oceans and the seas that contain the water in them. Now, Tan Rabbanan, Eretz Yisrael nivreit tchila. Kol ha'olam kulo nivra b'sof. Eretz Yisrael was created first, and then all the other lands were created afterwards. Shenemar, because the pasuk says in Mishlei, ad lo asa eretz, before the land was created, v'chutzot, and that which surrounded it, or that which was out in the fields. So the eretz, by default, the Gemara is going to assume, refers to Eretz Yisrael, and chutzot refers to things that are outside of Eretz Yisrael. Now this is figurative in the sense that Eretz Yisrael is the center of the spiritual world. It's the place where Hashem's Shekhinah resides, and therefore it's the most important land. And therefore it is the epicenter, primary land, and called Eretz. Everything else is ancillary to that, and that's why it's called Chutzot. And therefore the Gemara here brings a braita that says that Eretz Yisrael was created first. Now, how literally to take that is really based on a machloka that we saw back in the Gemara in Yoma, Daf Nun Dalet Amud Bet, where the Gemara there speaks about the Eben Hashtiyah that was found in the Kodesh HaKodeshim upon which the Aron sat. And the Gemara says, why was it called Eben Hashtiyah? Tana, Shemimenu Hushtat Ha'olam. From that stone, the world was created, or foundation stone of the world. Tnan Kemanda Amar, or our Mishnah in Yoma that says that, is like the one who says, Mitzion Nivra Ha'olam, that the world was created from Tzion. And then we have a four-way machloket in the Braita, the Tanya. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, who also appears over here, that Olam Em Tzioto Nivra. The world was created from the center. Rabbi Yeshua Omer, Olam Min Hatzdadim Nikra, that it was from the sides that the world was created. Then we have Rabbi Yitzchak, Damar Eben Yera HaKadosh Baruch Hu Bar Yam, that God threw a stone into the ocean, and from there, there was the foundation of the world. And then the last opinion is a Chachamim Arim Mitzion Nivra. It was built from Tzion. Now, it's clear that the opinion of the Chachamim, that it was created from Tzion, disagrees with the opinion of Rabbi Yeshua, says that it was Min Hatzdadim, whereas with Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yitzchak, it's not clear whether they necessarily argue, because maybe the middle of the world is Tzion. And if that's the case, if you say Mitzion Nivra, also when you say Mem Tzeyato, from the center it was created, is a similar statement. So how different those opinions are is questionable, but you have four opinions there. And then this Gemara here revolves around that opinion that Eretz Yisrael was the center of the earth, and from there the world was created. And therefore, before Hashem made the land and that which was outside of it, the land default refers to Eretz Yisrael, and Eretz Yisrael came before Chutzot, the other lands that were outside of it. And the Maharsha quotes from the Rashba, who has an extensive statement about what this means, and he says, I'll give you it in summary, that is, V'hu, she'ashkachato yitbarach baruchu, v'chol davar yoter be'Eretz Yisrael, u'b'shar etzot, ki elukei ha'aretz. God's Hashkacha in Eretz Yisrael is much more pronounced than the other lands. And that's why it's called by default Eretz, because that's where God's desire and want is. And therefore it's created first because that is the primary land. And all others are subordinate to it. And that's why they're called outside or chutz la'aretz. And we're going to see a series of other statements here in the Gemara that indicate a similar idea, that Eretz Yisrael is the center or is the focus of a Kaddish Baruch Hu. The Bach here changes the order of the Gemara, but we're just going to follow what's found in the text itself, which is Eretz Yisrael Mashkeu Ta Kaddish Baruch Hu Ba'atzmo. Eretz Yisrael is reigned upon by God himself. V'chol Ha'olam Kulo, the rest of the remainder of the world, Ayidei Shaliach, is done through a messenger. Shenamar, because the Pasuk says, Notei Matar Al Pnei Aretz, the one who places the rain on the land. V'sholeach, so that has an implication of Shliach, Maim Al Pnei Chutzot, waters unto those areas that are surrounding it. So again, the word Aretz is used to refer to Eretz Yisrael, and that is Natan. Hashem puts directly the rain onto it, but Sholeach, he does it through a Sholeach when it comes to the Pnei Chutzot, areas that are outside of Eretz Yisrael. It's interesting the Gemara didn't bring this, but the Gemara could have brought the Pasuk that's found in Parshat Ekev, which is right preceding the Parshia of Hayayim Shamoa. It says there, Garas Asher Atah V'Hashama L'Rishta Lok Eretz Mitzrayim Hi, Asher Yitzata Misham Asher Tizrat Zaracha V'Shkita Baragalacha Kegani Rak, V'Aretz Asher Atem Ovrim Shama L'Rishta Eretz Harim Ukol, Limtar HaShemayim Tishtemayim. It gets its sustenance, its water from the rain. Eretz Asher Hashem Lokecha Dorei Shota, place that Hashem is always interested or looking out for, Tamid Enei Hashem Lokecha Ba Mirishit HaShana V'Racharit HaShana. God's eyes are always upon the land. So it sounds from there that that's what God does. He provides the rain that is for Eretz Yisrael because he's constantly involved or interested in it. And that would have been another proof to this fact, although you wouldn't have the other side of it, which is that for the chutzot, for those things that are outside of Eretz Yisrael, it's v'sholeach mayim al pnei chutzot. Eretz Yisrael shoteh megeshamim. Eretz Yisrael gets fed or gets its water from the rain. Cholam kulo mitamsit. And the remainder of the world gets it from a derivative of that. Shenamar, and again, the Gemara is going to quote the same pasuk, Notei Matar al Pnei Eretz, and then V'sholeach al Pnei Chutzot. Eretz Yisrael Shoteh Tchila. Eretz Yisrael gets its water, gets fed first. V'chol Ha'gulam Kulo B'sof. And then the remainder of the world, afterwards, Shenamar, Hanotein Matar al Pnei Eretz. And again, here, the idea being that first, Hanotein Matar al Pnei Eretz, first, and only afterwards, V'sholeach Mayim al Pnei Chutzot. Mashal Le'Adam. It's similar to a person, shemegabelet ha'gvina, who is curdling the milk to make it into cheese. Once he's done that, notelet ha'ochel, he takes out that which he wants from the cheese. He's able to separate the parts of the milk into the cheese and then to the whey that's left over afterwards. And he meniach et ha'psolet. He leaves behind the milk water that comes from the making of the cheese. So even though everything looks the same, the milk is all the same, he can still differentiate. We can still create a distinction between them. And similarly with the lands, even though everything looks the same, there really is a distinction or a difference between them, and Eretz Yisrael is different than the other lands. Now the one thing we do have to address here is that the latter two statements of the Gemara seem to mean the same thing. The first of which is that God first gives Matar to Eretz Yisrael, and then the rest of the world gets whatever derivative of that is given to the rest of the world, and then it says also that Eretz Yisrael gets fed first, and then the world gets whatever is left over from that, which seems to be the same statement twice. There are those that explain that it is connected to the upcoming Gemara, which is Tamtzit, or a derivative, is not necessarily the derivative of Eretz Yisrael, but what it means, a Tamtzit of Gan Eden. It is a derivative of the waters of Gan Eden that's given to the remainder of the world. And so therefore, Eretz Yisrael gets rain and water through its rain, whereas the rest of the world gets fed from that water from Gan Eden. And then the second statement is that Eretz Yisrael is fed first, and then only the residual that's left over is given to the rest of the world, and that's the mashal that's brought with the cheese. Now, Amamar, the Gemara goes back to something that was stated by Rabbi Eliezer earlier, which is, how is it that if the waters of the oceans are salty, that the rain that falls is sweet water? How does it get rid of the salt? So the Gemara's answer for Rabbi Eliezer was, Mamtikim hein be'avim, that the clouds sweeten the water, in that they process the water to the point where it is now without salt in it. The true chemistry of what happens is that the sun heats the ocean waters, and the water evaporates from the ocean and leaves the salt behind, and then that water rises into the atmosphere, into the clouds, and therefore the water that's coming is water without salt because it's coming from evaporated water. So here they're describing that process as being mamtikim hein ba'avim, that the clouds themselves sweeten the water. Minale, how do we know where's that from? The pasuk says, now this is the Shirat David that's found both in Shmuel Bet and in Tehillim Yudchet, and there are slight variations between the two versions of Shirat David. The one that you're most familiar with is the Migdol and Magdil that are found at the end of benching. They're both found in the two different Shirot, one in Tehillim and one in Shmuel Bet. Here the Gemara is going to discuss another nuanced difference between them, and that is Chashchat Mayim Avei Shchakim. God created the tremendous dark waters and the thick clouds, Uchtiv, and then in Shmuel Bet it says Chashrat Mayim, that he created the heavy waters and Avei Shchakim and the thick clouds. So in one place it says Chashchat, in one place it says Chashrat. So the Gemara says, Shokul Kaf, take the Kaf from Chashchat, the Shadi Aresh, and put it together with the Resh in Chashrat, meaning make it into a single word, Bikari Bey, and then you'll read Hachsharat, or Hechsher, something that prepares, as the Mesorat HaShas says over here, Nichsharim Umimat Mekim, that they are prepared, processed, or sweetened. And therefore the Avei Shchakim, the thick clouds, process the water from the salty waters of the oceans and produce the sweet waters that are dropped from the rain. So that's Rabbi Eliezer's explanation for how it is that the waters are provided from the oceans, yet they are still sweet water. Rabbi Yoshua Bahani Krai Mai Dorish Behu. Rabbi Yeshua believes all the waters come from the heavens. What does he do with this inconsistency in the Psukim? What does he darshan from it? Savalaki Hadiata Rabdimi Amar. So he holds like what Rabdimi said, the Amri Bimarova. Rabdimi is one of those Amoraim that traveled back and forth between Eretz Yisrael and Bavel. And many times he was bringing Memrod from Eretz Yisrael. And here's no exception. He's bringing Amri Bimarova. They say in Eretz Yisrael, Nehor Anane Zeirin Mohi. If the clouds are thin and light, then it's going to produce very little rain. Chashuch Anane. If the clouds are dark and heavy and thick, Sagin Mohi. Then it has lots of water. Rashi doesn't have the word Mohi, but Memohi, which means its waters are heavy, and that will give heavy rains. Rashi claims that the limud is only one way here, which is that chashchat mayim, that when it comes to the dark clouds of Eishchakim, from that we know that you have thick clouds and lots of rain. So darkness means lots of rain. And then the Gemara is just assuming that that means the opposite is true as well, which is that if it's not a thick and dark cloud, then a light cloud is not going to have that rain. And it's not learned from the word chashrat, but learned from chashchat. And chashchat teaches you that there's one type of rain that's a heavy rain. And the chashrat, thereby the definition, is the opposite, or just the light rain from the light clouds. But not that they learn it out from the word itself. And Marsha says about Rashi's explanation, Chol zeh dachuk v'ikar chaser min ha-sefer, because then the main limud is missing from the Gemara itself. That's number one. And number two is it doesn't answer the discrepancy between chashchat and chashrat, because we're only darshaning one of the two words to be meaningful. And therefore the Marashoah says that chashchat is from the word chashuch, to be dark. And that's what we said before, that that's the reference to the dark and heavy clouds. And chashrat is from the word kvara, like a sieve. And that we learned earlier in the Gemara, that the heavens are like a sieve that allows the water to drip through it. And that's the difference, that you have a chashkat mayim, which is going to give you heavy rain and large drops, and you have a chashrat mayim, which is like a kvara, a sieve, that's going to let you little drops that come out, and that's the distinction that's being made over here, that's actually derived from the distinction in the words in the psukim. K'mana zahad Daniel, who does this brayta follow, meaning this machlok between Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Yoshua, mayim elyonim b'mamar him tluim, the upper waters are held in place by God's word, meaning that when God separated the waters, mitachat, the mayim mima'al, he put the rakia there. The rakia, is that a firmament that is a physical barrier, or is it held up by the word of a god? And so they have a braita that says that God said to the waters to stay there, and therefore they stay there. Uperotehem, and the derivative or the fruits of those waters are megishamim, are the rain. Shenemar, because it says, mipri ma'asecha, from the fruits of your labor, meaning referring to Akash Baruch Hu, tis ba'aretz, the land is sustained or satiated, and that's the rain that comes down, and that's the pri. And as Rashi notes over here, the definition of a pri is something that does not take away from that which is the principle. Just like we say, Elohim Devarim Shadam Ochol Peretem Olam Hazeh V'Keren Keren Olam Haba, the perot is something that can be taken away without reducing the principle or affecting the principle. And similarly over here, the pri, the fruits of the heavens, are the rain that comes down without reducing the waters that are there. And as Rashi quotes from the psukim that we saw in the previous dapim, which is Peleg Elokim Malei Mayim, that the river of God is filled with water, and the Gemara before said that it never empties. And then the Gemara had the mashal for the individual who didn't believe it, about when an individual sweats, and they still don't lose any weight, even though they're sweating. And similar to that, the sky or the heavens are sweating, are giving off water, but there's nothing reduced from the river of God, which is always full. But it's clear here that the waters are from the heavens above. So come on, that's like Rabbi Yeshua says that the source of the rain in the world comes from the waters that are held above in the heavens. Rabbi Eliezer, so what is Rabbi Eliezer going to do with this? That refers to the works of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the Marsha over here explains that when it comes to the Midrash that quotes this in the Yalkut, it has a slightly different quote, which is that's speaking about the creation of the world. That's what Rabbi Eliezer is saying. And therefore, the meaning there is, at creation, Hashem put in place the waters that will be the Tizba'aretz, will provide the sustenance for the land. So you created the waters, Mipri Masecha, the derivative of your creation, which is the waters in the oceans, they will provide Tizba'aretz, they will provide the water that will sustain the earth. And that's what it means, that Masei Yadecha, or Briyato Shel Olam, put in place the cycle which will provide the waters that will Tizba'aretz. Amar Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, Kol Olam Kulo, Mitamtzit Gan Eden Hu Shuteh. The entire world gets its water as a derivative of Gan Eden. Shenemar, because the pasuk says, "V'nar yotzei mi'Eden." Now the truth is that pasuk doesn't prove anything about Gan Eden, because that nahar comes out of Eden to feed the gan. And so what Rashi points out, many of the other Rishonim point out over here, is that it's just an example, which is that just like when it comes to Eden, which is the source, the derivative of that feeds the gan, the river that exits from there feeds the gan. So too, that which leaves the gan feeds the world is a derivative of the gan. So you have Eden. And then Gan Eden. Gan Eden gets the river from Eden, and that provides it a derivative of Eden, feeds Gan Eden. And similarly, that which goes from Gan Eden to the world, it's a derivative of Gan Eden that's providing to the world. And so it's just an example of how this works. So Tana, now we have an explanation of this in a broader sense, which is Mitamsit Beit Kur Shita Tarkav. From a amount, derivative of a amount of water that could saturate or irrigate a Beit Kur, you have left over usually enough to irrigate a Tarkav, which is Trei Vikav, is 3 Kavin. A Kur is 30 Sa'ah. Each Sa'ah is 6 Kav, which is 180 Kav. And a Tarkav is Trei Vikav, or a Tri Kav, which is 3 Kavin. So 3 over 180 is 1/60. And that's what it's saying, that when you pour water to feed an area that's a Beit Kur, which is the equivalent of 75,000 square amot, because the Mishkan was 2 Beit Sa'ah, and it's 50 by 100, so 50 by 50 is a Sa'ah, which is 2,500 square amot, and a Kur is 30 Sa'ah, so 30 times that will give you 75,000 square amot. So an area of 75,000 square amot that you could use the water to irrigate it, there's usually either from there, it gives derivatives to other gardens, or the water that used to pour, that which is left at the bottom of the barrels, and extra drips, they add up to Trei Kav, or 1/60 of it. And so this is the idea that all of these items are 1/60 or tamsit of the source from which they come from. And that's a terminology that we see many times in Chazal with regards to Shabbat, is me'en olam haba. It's like 1/60 of olam haba. Sheina, sleeping, is like 1/60 of mitah, of death. The 1/60 in Bavel is one of the larger numbers in the base 6 system, and therefore 60 is always used as a number, like for Ta'am, as being a number that's big enough that says that it's not relevant anymore. That's why if you have 60 times something, there's no relevance of Ta'am. And so 60 is a reference to something where you have a very large item. 1/60 of that would be a small derivative of that item. It's a typological number, not an exact number. But the idea being that Eden provides to Gan Eden. Gan Eden provides to the world. Similar to the way that a Beit Kur, when you irrigate it, has the residual that is usable for a smaller area of 3 kav, or 1/60 of that. Tanur banan, Eretz Mitzrayim havya, dal meot parsa, dal meot parsa, 400 by 400 parsaot. Similar Gemara in the Gemara in Pesachim that says that about Eretz Yisrael, and that provides a little bit of an issue in terms of traveling, which we'll see coming up in the next coming Mishnah. Ruachad mishishim b'kush. And that's 1/60 of Kush. Kush is much bigger than Mitzrayim, and therefore Mitzrayim is 1/60 of the size of Kush. Kush, echad mishishim b'olam. And Kush is 1/60 of the entire world. Ve'olam, and the world is, Echad Mishishim B'Gan, is 1/60 of Gan Eden. B'Gan, Echad Mishishim L'Eden. Gan Eden is 1/60 of the Eden. Now over here we're not talking about the water sourcing, but rather the size of it. Ve'Eden, Echad Meisamech L'Geinom. And Eden is 1/60 of Geinom. Nimtza Kol Olam Kulo Kikisui K'deira L'Geinom. Therefore the world is like so de minimis. It's so small, it's like the cover of a pot relative to the pot, which is a very small or insignificant item. Because you're starting with Gan Yedom, 1/60 of that is Eden, 1/60 of the Eden is Gan, 1/60 of the Gan is the world. So you're already three derivatives away, or 1/216,000, which is 60 to the third differential between that, the size of Gan Yedom and the size of the world. Some people say that there is no boundaries or limit to how big Gan Yedom is. That Eden has no shiur to it. And again, with regards to Gan Yedom, that's because most of the people in the world don't do the right thing or don't act appropriately, and therefore they land in Gan Yedom, so you need to have a lot more space in Gan Yedom than anywhere else. Eden is the place which is the source of the world, so we don't want it to have any limits because it's something that's a spiritual or divine source, and so there should be no limitation to that, and therefore Eden has no shiur according to this view in the Gemara. And the relationship between Gan Yedom and Eden is definitely a commentary on how Chazal believe most people in the world, how they behave, or what they are worthy of based on their behavior, and that most people are going to end up in Gan Yedom and not in Eden, and that's why there's a differential in size, according to the first view here, that Gan Yedom is 60 times the size of Eden. I'm Rabbi Hoshaya, my dichtiv, what is meant by the pasuk? Shulchan talmaim rabim, rabat otsarot. You dwell upon large areas of water, and therefore rabat otsarot, and therefore there are large storehouses there. The pashtuta pasuk is that you are sitting on maim rabim, tons of water that are stored in these massive storehouses. The Gemara is going to bifurcate the pasuk and say, shulchan talmaim rabim, because you live on an area that's blessed with water, rabat otsarot, therefore you get large silos full of grain, you have great produce that comes from there. Migaram the Bavel, shiotsrotem leot bar. Why is Bavel such a fertile and agriculturally productive area? Because it sits on large stores of water, and the Gemara believes that because Bavel was a low-lying area, and you have the fertile crescent, you have the Tigris and Euphrates rivers flowing down into that area, so there's plenty of water, and the land is saturated with water, even without rainfall. And that's the next statement of the Gemara, Amarav Atira Bavel. Bavel is very wealthy, the chatzta below Mitra. You're able to harvest without any rain. The rainfall, the average rainfall in that area of Iraq and the Baghdadian area between the Tigris and Euphrates is limited, yet it's a very fertile crescent because of the fact that there's so much water flowing in the rivers from other areas to there, and the rivers and their channels or canals that are brought out of them feed the land and make it into a very fertile area. And so therefore it's an area that doesn't depend on rain, but rather is saturated and blessed with abundant water, and that abundance of water, which is Maim Rabim, gives you Rabat Otsarot, gives you a production that is very great, even though there's not a lot of rain. Amar Abaye Naktina, and therefore we conclude, Tovani Velo Yevoshani. It's a very difficult statement of Abaye, it seems to be obvious. The simple reading is that it's better to be, or the moisture and not the dryness. Rashi explains that he Makom Mitsula Virakak, Bavel is an area that's saturated, swampy, full of water and mud, and it's not dry. But that seems to be an obvious conclusion from that which was said in the Gemara. And Tosafot makes a similar statement, Perish, Mutavliot Be'eret Shi Lacha, Shi Yevesha. It's better to be in a moist land than into a dry area. Both of those just seem to be obvious outcomes of everything we said until now. And the Orach, as you can see in the Masorah de Shas, says, Klomer Mutav Shie Matar Harbei Miot Chorev B'li Matar. It's better to be in a place where there's tons of rain than to be in a location which is dry, without rain, which again seems to be an obvious conclusion from what we're seeing over here. And what is Abaye adding then if he's saying that? So if you look in the Benu Gershom over here, he says, Tovani velo yobshani klomar mitzirame shetovim hazarim avalolam en mityabshim. So Abaye says that the seeds always have significant or sufficient moisture to allow them to germinate, and they never dry out. Despite the fact that there's no rain, the saturation or moisture in the ground allows the seeds to germinate. So that's the conclusion according to the Rabbeinu Gershom, which seems to be a little bit more significant conclusion or summary of what we've seen until now. Okay, now we move on to the next Mishnah, and this comes back to the halachot that we discussed back on Daf Dalet and on Daf Vav, which is Begimel v'mar Cheshvan shualim et hagshamim. Starting on the third of Cheshvan, you begin to ask for rain. Rabbi Gamliel omer b'shivabo, that you start to ask for rain on the seventh of Mar Cheshvan, which is the practice in Eretz Yisrael, Tet Vav Yom Achar Achag, 15 days after the end of Sukkot, Kedei Shegiyah Acharon Shevisrael Enar Prat, so the last traveler who had come up on the other regel could return home, which is 14 days away, And that's the assumption of the Gemara of the distance to Nahar Prat for the people to reach the edge of the borders of the greater Eretz Yisrael. And Prat, likely because fertile area, it's a well-populated area, and therefore they wanted to allow those people to return home before they asked for rain. The Gemara here says, Amar Belazar, halacha ki Rabbi Gamliel. Similar to what we saw back on Daf Vav, the Gemara here says that halacha is like Rabbi Gamliel, and we begin to ask for Tein Talum Atar Livrachaim Barich Aleinu, starting on the 7th of Cheshvan. The question is, what is the real reason for the fact that we start on the 7th of Cheshvan? So look back on Daf Vav, there the Gemara brought three different opinions as to what were the Onota Gshamim. It was the Reviyah Rishona, Reviyah Shniyah, and Reviyah Shlishit. Rabbi Meir believed that it was on the 3rd, 7th, and 17th of Cheshvan. Rabbi Yehuda believed that it was on the 7th, the 17th, and the 23rd. And Rabbi Yossi believed it was on the 17th, the 23rd, and the 1st of Kislev. Those were the three Riviyot. And the Gemara said, my nafkamina for those Riviyot. And the Gemara concluded that the first Riviyah was determinate as to when you start asking for rain, which based on the first Riviyah. According to Rabbi Meir, you'd start on the 3rd. According to Rabbi Yehuda, you would start on the 7th. And according to Rabbi Yossi, start on the 17th. So that would match up with our Mishnah because the Tana Kama, which is Stam Mishnah, would be Rabbi Meir, and he says that you start on the 3rd of Cheshvan. And Rabbi Yehuda was the one who said on the 7th, Rabbi Gamliel would be holding like Rabbi Yehuda. And that's why Rashi, back on the Vav Amud Aleph, changed the Girsa in the Gemara, based on his Rebbeim, to not Halacha ki Rabbi Yossi, but rather Halacha ki Rabbi Yehuda. Because that way you can reconcile between the Shita of Rabbi Yehuda and the Shita of Rabbi Gamliel. But then the question is, what is the driving force here? Is it because they have a Mesorah, like Rashi says over here, Halacha l'Moshe Mitzinai, that they have a Mesorah, that those were the Reviyot, those are the time periods for the Reviyot, and Rabbi Yehuda's opinion is 7, 17, and 23rd. And here Rabbi Gamliel gives a logical argument as to why that is the case, because it's the 15 days after the Chag is the 7th, and that's the appropriate time to start, because everybody then can get home dry before you start asking for rain. So that would, first of all, bring up the question as to Rabbi Meir here, on Gimel Bar Cheshvan, who's the Tana Kama of our Mishnah, is he saying Gimel Bar Cheshvan because that's the Ona Rishona, or the Reviyah Rishona, or is he saying that because he also thinks that that's sufficient time for everybody to get back home, and he had 15 days is enough, you don't need everybody to get back home, most people will make it home by 15 days, the other people can hurry up and get there. There's also a question with regards to Gamliel's position, as to how do you deal with the fact that there's also Shabbat in the interim there, and they can't travel in those days. So is this enough time, excluding Shabbat or including Shabbat? Anyway, all of those are interesting, but the more important thing is what's the correlation between that which we saw in Daf Vav and which we saw over here, plus we had back on Daf Dalet a different reason given for the fact that they start in Zayin Mar Cheshvan, and that's the difference between Bavel and Eretz Yisrael, which was the fact that they have their fruits out in the field drying, and therefore they didn't want to ask for rain before they brought in the fruits from the fields to dry, and then they would ask for the rain. So you see different reasons for the 7th. It's also good to note over here that the fact that it falls out 15 days after Yom Tov is Zayin Cheshvan is only according to our calendar. We have a fixed calendar, Tishrei is always Malay. But in times where they were Mekadesh or Piyariyah, there was a possibility that Tishrei was a Chaser. If Tishrei was a Chaser, then it would fall out on the 8th of Cheshvan. In that case, which one governs over here? Is it the 15 days that governs, and therefore you go to Chet Cheshvan? Or is it that the first Reviyah is on the 7th, and therefore that determines, and even if it's less than 15 days, we do it on the 7th? So that would be a question as to which one is the primary reason over here. Or do we say that since in most cases the 15th day will coincide with the 7th of Mar Cheshvan, even when it doesn't coincide, we tell people to hurry up a little bit and we only do 14 days? I mean, it's a question of how you balance between these two reasons. And there will be, in a sense, a nafkamina between them, and this the Ran raises over here, which is that what happens post-Churban HaBayit? Post-Churban HaBayit, you no longer have this issue of the Aliyah Regel and people returning home. So if you believe that returning home is the main issue, then if that's not relevant anymore, maybe we should start saying or asking for rain much earlier. So that's one possibility. Maybe that means go back to the 3rd, like Rabbi Meir, who says that's the earliest time of the Reviyah. Or maybe it's the reason here is not only because of this, but also because of the Reviyot. And therefore, since the Reviyah, or the first Reviyah of Rabbi Yehuda is the 7th, and that's already the second Reviyah of Rabbi Meir, the Gemara thought that that was the right time period to start, irrespective of how long it takes to come home. It also happens to work out that it allows everybody to get back home at the same time. So it's a dual reason that might still be applicable even after Churban HaBayit, or the possibility that the Ran raises over here, which is the fact that even after the Churban HaBayit, they still used to do Aliyah LeRegel. They used to gather in Yerushalayim for the Chagim, and so it was still relevant for people to be able to get home, even though there wasn't a Beit HaMikdash that was extant at that time. And that would still have relevance after Churban HaBayit. But this is a discussion in Machloki within the Rishonim as to whether this still has relevance, even after post-Achurban, or maybe it goes back to the Gemara and Dav Dalet, which also discussed the fact that the having the dry fruits in the field are also have implications for the rain starting the rainy season, and therefore we need to give them room or time for that. So there are multiple reasons that are indicating why it has to be on the 7th of Cheshvan, and maybe even if one of them is missing, the others are still intact, or we have to ask, which is the primary reason, is it the date of the Riviyah, and therefore the Churban HaBayit is not impactful on it, or does it have to do with the traveling of the people, if that's the most important thing, then maybe that changed post-Churban, once there's no need for people to go back, or if they did continue to go to Yerushalayim, maybe that need is still there, and therefore they waited. But nevertheless, that is the halacha that we start asking, Tein Talamato Livrachaim Baruch Aleinu, starting on the 7th of Cheshvan, as opposed to Mashiva Ruach Umarid HaGoshem, which we start on in Musaf of Shmini Atzeret, Mashachari, we still say Morid HaTal, and then we again sing Mashiva Ruach Umarid HaGoshem in Musaf of Shmini Atzeret. Now Gemara says, Tanya Chananya Omer Ubigola, in the Gola, here it seems to be a reference to Bavel, Ad Shishim B'Tkufa, 60 days after the Tkufa, which is the fall equinox, and 60 days later is when you would begin to ask for rain, Amar Rav Huna, Amar Barchi, Amar Shmuel, Halacha Kechananya. So we have now a Psak Halacha that the Halacha is like Chananya. So that means in Eretz Yisrael, the ruling is that we start asking for rain on the 7th of Cheshvan. And the ruling, according to most Rishonim here, for Bavel, which is what the Gemara seem to be speaking about, the Ritva makes that clear over here, that just goes back on what we saw before, Atira Bavel. Bavel is wealthy or rich because it has plenty of water even without rain, and therefore there's no need to ask for rain until a much later date. And that later date is 60 days after the Tukufa. The Ine, is that really true? When do we start asking for rain in Bavel? And Shmuel is residing in Bavel. When they start bringing the wood in to the house of Tavut was a proper name. Tavut Rishba, the Gemara in other places, and Rashi says over here as well, seems that Rishba is a fowler, someone was a bird hunter. So when they start to bring in the wood for to that house, that's one possibility. If you look in the Masoret HaShas, he quotes from the Gaonim the possibility that it means Rosh Beit Av or Nisi Beit Av. It's actually a acronym. The Rishba over here means that Tavut, who was an important family or leader of a family or a clan, and when they start to bring wood into the house, that's when it was the time to ask for rain. The reason they brought the wood into the house is because it was the beginning of the rainy season, and when the wood gets wet, it would not be good for firewood. According to Rashi, it'd be hard to cut the wood at that point, or be difficult to split the wood at that point, and therefore there's an indication of when you start. But that's not necessarily 60 days after the Tkufa. And the Rabbeinu Gershom over here has a slightly different explanation. He says that Davashir, this Tavot was very wealthy. They were out drying in the field. Ad Shikansein B'mar Cheshvan, until he brought them in Cheshvan. Necessarily Cheshvan, whatever, 60 days after the Tkufa. He used to bring them in, so he has a slightly different explanation as to why he was the determining factor, but he was a wealthy individual who was drying tons of wood out in the field, and they used to bring him in to protect them from the rain. That was the time period where you want to start asking for the rain when it's the natural rainy season. So Dilma says, how do you know that? It's possible that they're the same time. I mean, it's an indication or symptomatic of what 60 days after the Tkufa is, and Shmuel doesn't necessarily disagree. He thinks that 60 days after Tkufa is just giving you a way to know round when that is, when that normally falls out. Ibayaluhu. So the Gemara asks, Yom Shishim, Kalifnei Shishim. Is the 60th day itself, like the days before where you don't say, Tein Talumato Livracha, O Kalachar Shishim? Or is it like after the 60th day? Tashma. Rav Amar, Yom Shishim, Kalachar Shishim. Rav says, the 60th day is like the next day, meaning that you start saying Tein Talumato Livracha already on the 60th day. Ushmul Amar, Yom Shishim, Kalifnei Shishim. That the 60th day is like beforehand and you do not say Tein Talamato Livracha. So usually in these cases where you have a machloket here, with regards to Advar Bichlal, you would just say we go the Chumrah. But here the problem is that there is no Chumrah. Because it's a Chumrah in both directions, or a Kula in both directions. Because if you say Tein Talamato Livracha at the wrong time, then you have failed to properly daven Shmoneh Esrei. If you omit Tein Talamato Livracha when you're supposed to be saying it, then that's also a problem in the Shmoneh Esrei. So since there's no real Chumrah here, that can't be the way that we make a determination with regards to this. So the way to remember whose opinion here belongs to whom is Eli Bo Maya. The ones in the higher elevations require water. Tatai Lo Bayamaya. Those in the lower elevations do not require water. So the way Rashi explains this is that Rav derived from Eretz Yisrael. He came from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel. And therefore he came from the highlands of Eretz Yisrael And so he believes that you need to start asking earlier because he needs more rain because he came from Eretz Yisrael where they always needed rain. And Shmuel, who lived in Bavel, which was the lower lying lands, which we saw before, had plenty of water even without rain. He said you can postpone, you can wait to say it. Marsha is bothered by Rashi's explanation because Rashi's explanation seems to indicate that Eretz Yisrael is still influential on when they start asking in Bavel. Rav is now in Bavel, so why is it relevant that he came from Eretz Yisrael? So you could answer simply that if that's just the siman, that is a way to remember whose opinion is what. It's not that that's the reason for his opinion. On the other hand, if you do look at the Rabbeinu Hananel, he gives a slightly different explanation, but he also changes around the shita of Rav and Shmuel. It says, Rav Amar Milifnei Samach, that Rav says that it's like the 60 days like the day before, Shmuel Amar Kelachar Samach, that's like the day afterwards. And how do I remember this? Simanech, Ilai Boi Maya, Tata Lo Boi Maya, Perish. Narda, Hatreda Shmuel, Narda, which was the Beit Midrash, the city of Shmuel, was Gvah, was higher up the river, the Haim of Akshimayim, and therefore they needed more water. They had higher elevation and higher up the river, and therefore they needed more water. The Surah, which was the city of Rav, and where his Beit Midrash was, Hatreda Rav, Uda Gabe, Narda, Tata. In relationship to Narda, it was at a lower elevation, in a lower location, and therefore, Hain, Enam of Akshimayim, they don't need water because the water there just pools in their area because it's such a deep or shallow, low-lying area, and so they don't need water. The Gemara says here, Amar Papa Hilchata Yom Shishim Klacha Shishim, that the 60th day is like the day after, meaning in our Gemara, the way that Rav says it, that would make sense because you have a Machloket Rav and Shmuel, and Beisurei Aloha is Kirav, so here we would be Paskin like Rav. According to the Rabbeinu Hananel's Girsa, then Rav Papa's statement is Paskin like Shmuel, and it's not clear why you would Paskin like Shmuel over here versus Rav, with regards to something that's Isurei, so that explanation of the Rabbeinu Hananel is a little more difficult because of that. So now there are two major issues that arise from this Gemara over here. The first of which is that the Gemara clearly defines for Eretz Yisrael that the beginning of the She'ilah, asking for rain, is Tein Talamat Livracha, is on Zayim Mar Cheshvan. And for Bavel, it says that it's clear that it's 60 days after the Tkufa. The Ritva over here, as well as the Rambam and the Perush HaMishnayot, are clear that they think that you have to look at every land independently and compare it to the climate in each of these areas. So areas that are near Eretz Yisrael that have the same climate as Eretz Yisrael, they should have their starting point of when they ask for rain, similar to Eretz Yisrael and Zayim Rakeshvan. Those areas that have a similar climate to Bavel and are like Bavel, they should also ask for rain the same way that Bavel does, which is on the 60th day after the Tkufa. That leaves open the question as to lands, for instance, in Europe, what is the din with regards to starting to ask for rain there? So there is a shita in the Gaonim, which the Ritva mentions, which is the practice that both Rashi and the Tosafot over here suggest was well accepted, which is that we are subject to the Talmud Bavli, and therefore whatever Paskin the Talmud Bavli applies to anyone who is in Chutz Laaretz or anyone who's outside of Eretz Yisrael. And therefore they believe, if you look in the Tosfot over here, he says, that's the practice. That's our practice. That's our minog. And Rashi says a similar thing over here. We also practice this way. We always follow the Bavli and not the Yerushalmi. This is very interesting because it comes to a head in a Tshuvat HaRosh, an amazing Tshuvat HaRosh. It is written in the year 1313, 5073. The Briyat HaOlam. It's found in the Shulta Rosh, Klal Revi'i Siman Yud. And over there he explains that he has been bothered by this problem, which is that the climate and the precipitation in Europe are very different than that which is found in Bavel. And why should Bavel dictate that which happens in these areas or these lands? And he says that when he was in Germany, he put forth his reasoning to his Rebbeim, and they said that what he said made sense, but where they were in Germany, they didn't need to do such a thing. But then the Rosh says that he traveled towards France, and when he got to Provence, he found that they actually started to ask for rain on the 7th of Mar Cheshvan, like B'nai Eretz Yisrael, because they needed rain earlier. They didn't need it like B'nai Bavel. And the Rosh was so excited, he thought that that was a great thing. And then he asked them, why don't you then do it in the back end? Because in the back end, it's even more important. The rain that they need between Pesach and Shavuot is essential and crucial to the success of the crops in those areas. And so he said, why do you stop saying the Tein Talamot Livracha on the first day of Pesach? Why don't you wait till later on, until after Shavuot, in order to stop it? So they said, because the Minog Avotenu B'Yadenu is that we start early on Zayin Cheshvan, like Eretz Yisrael, but we stopped at Pesach. but we're going to convene the Rabbanim of the area, and we're going to try to come to a conclusion. The Rosh says he left before he ever heard what they did with it. He doesn't know what they did. But his situation was now he's found in southern France or in Spain, where he's a Rav in the community there, and he's held his tongue for many years because the minhag was to follow that of Bavel 60 days after the Tkufa, and to end by Pesach time, which he thought was ridiculous, and he lays out the substance of what his argument is, which is, first of all, the Gemara is very clear that Zayin Mar Cheshvan has to do with the rain and the climate of Eretz Yisrael. And 60 days after Tukufa is clearly tied to the climate and the rain of Bavel. And therefore it's clear that the Gemara is depending or determining the start of the rain or asking for rain based on where you live, on the locale where you are. And that should be true in Europe as well, especially, which he points out now, that there are many times that after Pesach time, when they stopped asking for rain, that the need for rain was so essential that they were koveya fast days with Yugimel Midot, and then on Shabbat and Yom Tov, where they couldn't fast, they still were saying to Yugimel Midot because the situation was so dire that they needed rain. So here they're begging for rain, having fast days for rain, and they stop asking for rain at Pesach time. He says, I don't understand. So he saw this as his big opportunity because they were going to say to Yugimel Midot the next day in Shul on the first day of Pesach, asking for rain. He said, this is my big opportunity to change the ruling here. And so he gathered together many chachamim of the city. The tour, his son, says that he was present at this, and they discussed it, and he laid out for them his logic as to why he thinks that they should be able to say Tein Talamata Levivcha past Pesach. And they call in the chazan, who's going to be davening the next day in Shul, and they tell him that don't stop saying Tein Talamata Levivcha, continue to say it even afterwards, because we're going to continue saying it based on this Pesach of the Rosh. And he won over the acquiescence of many of the Talmidei Chachamim there in his area city. But the truth was that he didn't ask everybody. And what happens is the next day after they get this going, there are some people start to cry and scream that he's changing something. And who does he have the right to do to come along and change the practices of many years and the din of the Gaonim? And who gave him the right to do this? So he made the mistake of not including everybody in the city in his decision. He got most of the people who agreed with him, but those that disagreed were stronger, louder, and more powerful, and they basically shut down his effort to extend the din of Tein Talamata Livracha past Pesach time. And obviously he wasn't successful at starting earlier, which was less relevant to them. It still was helpful, but the more relevant was the extending it beyond Pesach, and that he's not successful at doing. And he says in this tshuva that he's writing this on Chol HaMoed, he held this peace, he didn't say anything after they cried against him and stopped him from doing this in Shul. He didn't argue on the spot, but he took out his time to write on Chol HaMoed to explain his position and his opinion with regards to this. Unfortunately, the Rosh's position was not accepted, the halacha, and you can see that in Shulchan Aruch.
Aruch Chaim, Siman Kuf Yud Zayin.
For the Shulchan Aruch Paskins, Birkat HaShanim, Tzarich Lomar Ba, Bimot HaGshamim, Tein Talumotor. Matrim Lisho Matar Bechutz Laretz Betfilat Arvid Shel Yom Samech Achar Tkuvat Tishrei, 60 days after the equinox, V'yom Tkufa Hu Bichlau, and you count the Yom Tkufa, the day of the equinox as well. But Eretz Yisrael Matrim Lisho Milel Zayin Be'omar Cheshvan, you start on the 7th of Cheshvan. Shualim Ad Tfilat HaMincha Shel Erev Yom Tov HaRishon Shel Pesach Misham Be'elach Poskim Lisho. You don't ask after that. And then, in Sif Bet, it says, Yechidim Atzrichim Lematar Bimot HaChama, individuals who need rain in the summertime, In Sholatim Otah BeBirkat HaShanim, you don't have a right to ask for that in Birkat HaShanim, Elo B'Shomei HaTfilah, V'Afilu Ir Gdola K'Ninveh, even a city as great as Ninveh, or Eretz Achad Kula, K'mo Sfarad Bichlala, or Ashkenaz Bichlala, Ki Yechidim Damli B'Shomei HaTfilah, even a great city like Ninveh, or a land like Spain, or Germany, they have a din like Yechidim, and they have to ask in Shomei HaTfilah. Mio, in Be'eretz Achat Kula Tzrichim Chaser B'Mot Matar B'Mot HaChama. If it's one large area, a whole country, that needs rain during the summer, Toba Yochid V'Shal Matar B'Birkat HaShanim. If a person makes a mistake and asks for Geshem in Birkat HaShanim, Choser U'Mitpalel B'Torat Nidava below She'ila B'Birkat HaShanim. He has to repeat Shmon Esrei because he asked for rain at a time that was not correct to ask for rain. But he has to do it as a tefillat nidava. Aval enu mechuyav lachzor klal. But he does not have to go back and do it. Why? So you can see here in the footnotes, it quotes, Beit Yosef b'shem Ma'ari, v'aramban v'aran, svir lehu keharosh. It's based on the Shut HaRosh. That people are afraid of the Shut HaRosh here, who says that there's a distinction between a city that needs, or individuals that need rain, where you have to ask for a Shema Tefillah versus a whole country or a land like Ashkenaz, Sfarad, and Sarfat that all needed rain, then those areas are considered to be a large enough swath of land that they should be able to ask for it in Birkat HaShanim. And therefore, the Shulchan Aruch, when he paskins over here, says that we stop at Pesach. And if you need rain, you can ask in Shema Tefillah, not in Birkat HaShanim. But if somebody made a mistake after Pesach, in a place like Sfarad or in Sarfat, where they need rain even after Pesach, and he makes a mistake and says, Tei Talamotar in Barech Aleinu, he can't go back and daven, assuming that he did it wrong. Because according to the Rosh, he did the right thing. And therefore the Shulchan Aruch is worried, he doesn't have to go back, it says, Imrotzeh, that's what the Ramah adds, and if he chooses to do it, and he's not Mechuyav to do it, then he has to do it as a Tefillat Nedava. And so even though the Rosh didn't win, quote-unquote, the battle, he still wins a little bit in the war, because in the end, we are choshesh for the Shita to Rosh, in the sense that if someone makes a mistake after Pesach in an area where rain is needed, we don't make them go back, and if they do go back, they have to do it as a Tefillat Nedava. So that was one issue, and that obviously has ramifications today, where, for instance, in Eretz Yisrael, only 5 to 7% of the economy is agrarian, and therefore the rain or the need for rain is not really driven by the agrarian side, but driven by the economic side of the need for water, for drinking, and for other uses in the economy. And therefore, maybe there's also, even in Eretz Yisrael, a change in the dynamic of starting in Zayin Mar Cheshvan and ending on Pesach, because we could use rain that is more extensive and over a larger period of time, because it would help us. And just to put it out there, that based on the Rosh, that maybe that has to be something that needs to be taken into consideration when we think about when we ask for rain and the need for rain, because the agriculture is not the main facet of what the rain is driving today, but rather the broader economy and the need for drinking water. The second thing we have to discuss is that everybody knows that when it comes to the equinox, the equinox falls out on September 22nd, 60 days after September 22nd would fall out on November 20th, and a year before a leap year where the equinox is on September 23rd, then 60 days later would be November 21st. And that's not the practice. Their practice is to start in Chutz La'aretz on December 4th and December 5th, not on November 20th and not November 21st. Now, with regards to the difference between the 4th and the 5th, first of all, it has to do with when you would start. Your day to start is either the 5th or the 6th of December. And since in Halacha, the night before is the time when we start, then for the night of December 4th, which is going into December 5th, is when you start saying it. Or if it's on December 6th, then on the night of December 5th, you begin saying it. The difference between December 4th and December 5th is that the solar year is 365 and a quarter days. Those quarter days accumulate over 4 years to be a full day. And that's why we have a leap year every 4 years in order to account for that quarter day differential each year to add up. So in a year before a secular leap year, then there's already accumulated enough time that it's a day later that both the equinox will fall on the 23rd instead of the 22nd of September, and the 60 days later will be a day later. And so therefore, instead of it falling out on December 5th, it falls out on December 6th. As soon as you adjust the calendar in the subsequent year for the leap year, by doing such, you then push an extra day into the calendar. The subsequent year, the equinox will go back to September 22nd, and 60 days later will be November 20th, or in the way we have it, it will throw out on December 5th instead of December 6th. And therefore, you'd start on December 4th and not December 5th. The question is, how do we get from November 20th or 21st, which is 60 days after what is the known equinox, to what we have today as December 4th or 5th as the beginning of saying Tein Talamata Livracha? This goes back to an issue that Shmuel is the one who gives us the calculations for the solar year. And he sets up the tkufot, which are the seasons of the year, which are broken into four. He says each season is 91 days and 7.5 hours. That's because if you take 365 and a quarter and divide it by four, you get each season being 91 days, 7.5 hours. And that's how Shmuel calculated the year. If that is the correct calculation of a solar year, then the equinoxes and the solstices, which are defined by these gaps or intervals of 91 days and 7.5 hours, they would give you the same day every year. And that was the basis of what's called the Julian calendar. And that is that they did exactly what we have in the secular calendar today. They had every 4 years, they had to add in an extra day as a leap year in order to correct for the fact that it was 365 and a quarter. And that putting in the leap year or putting in that extra day adjusted it so it would account for those extra accumulation of those quarter days. And in that way, it would keep everything on a fixed cycle or proper cycle for the solar calendar. What ended up happening was that by the time that they reached the year 325 CE of the Common Era, the church already realizes that this Julian calendar is not exactly working properly, and then they reset the equinox to be on March 21st to set up the holiday of Easter. But then after that, they let everything run again on the Julian calendar. By the time you reach the year 1582, it's become clear that the equinox is no longer on September 22nd or 23rd, but it's falling out in somewhere in the middle of October. And what has happened, or what they have realized, is that the calculation of the solar year is not correct. That 365 and a quarter is a good estimation, but it's not the actual number. The actual number is somewhere along the lines of 365.242189. That's in the year 2000, what the average duration of a solar year is, but that leaves you with a differential between the 365 and a quarter and the actual solar year. Well, it's very small, it's 0.0075 of a day, but that accumulates over a millennium, over thousands of years that starts to accumulate. And that is that residual amount, that the differential between 365 and a quarter and the real solar duration, which is 365.242189, adds up over time and starts pushing the Julian calendar to slide along what's the real solar year. And that is, if you take that number and divide it by one, you figure out that every 128, 133 years, depends whether you're comparing it to the Gregorian calendar or you're comparing it to the astronomical solar year, there is a day that's being added on. And so by the time you get to the year 1582, there's already passed enough time that there's actually a 10-day, close to a 10-day differential between what is actually the equinox and what the Julian calendar is telling us should be the equinox, because you take a 1582 minus 325, which was the last time they adjusted the calendar, and then you divide that by 128, which is the number of years it takes for a day to move, and you come out with like 9.8 days. And if you do it with 133 years, you get about 9.5 days. So the calendar's already moved 10 days off of what is supposed to be the proper day. And so Pope Gregory at that time, that's why it's called the Gregorian calendar, decided to fix the problem. What they did was they said that they're going to change in that year. Thursday was going to be October 4th, and the Friday right after, the next day, was going to be October 15th. And that way they would catch up in those 10 days that they had gone off on the calendar. But they realized that that's only a temporary solution, because that solution will bring them back on track. But then the same thing will happen over the next 1,000 years. You're going to have the same problem. And so to solve the problem, they actually realized, and this is, we can do the calculation ourselves here, which is that the differential between the Julian calendar, 365 and a quarter, and the actual astronomical solar year, it turns out that every 133 years or so, it adds a day to the calendar. So over a 400-year period, that would add 3 days to the calendar. So what they figured out was, well, you have to take out 3 days every 400 years. So the way they solved that problem was that every century that is not divisible by 400 would not be a leap year. So that means in the year 100, you would not have a leap year. Year 200, you would not have a leap year. Year 300, you would not have a leap year. Year 400, you would have a leap year. So that way you would eliminate 3 days from the Julian calendar by converting it into this Gregorian calendar. You'd have 3 years that would, it should have been leap years, that were not leap years. And that adjustment would cause the Gregorian calendar to stay on track. Now the Gregorian calendar is still not perfect to the astronomical calendar. It still has a differential, but its differential is so much smaller that it takes over 3,000 years to accumulate a day in the calendar. But nevertheless, it's on a much better system. Now, what happened was that when the Gregorian calendar was put into place in the year 1582, it was not necessarily widely accepted. It took a long time. It was accepted in Britain first, but in many other countries, it took a long time for Russia, not until after the Revolution in the 1917s did they actually accept the Gregorian calendar. And that's why the Russian Orthodox Church still works on the Julian calendar. And that's why their Xmas, their holiday, Chag HaMolad, turns out to be on January 7th, I think now, and not on December 25th. And similarly, in Halacha, the Halacha calendars follow the Julian calendar. That's because Shmuel's calendar and the Julian calendar are the same. And therefore, we are shifting along the Gregorian calendar. Every time the Gregorian calendar skips a leap year, that means that in the year 100, 200, 300, when they skip a leap year, the Julian calendar moves a day ahead on the Gregorian calendar, because they have a leap year where the Gregorian calendar doesn't have it. And so that's what happens in the Jewish calendar when we're calculating the equinox. Every time they eliminate a leap year for the Gregorian calendar, we still have a leap year based on the Julian calendar, the calculation of Shmuel. So we know that in the year 1582, they already adjusted for 10 days. We didn't accept that, so we know already then there's 10 days of shifting in the calendar that's already happened by then. Since then, we've had a number of years, which are 1600 was a leap year because it's divisible by 400. 1700, 1800, and 1900 were all non-leap years in the Gregorian calendar, but were leap years in the Julian calendar. So that means we pushed out another 3 days. And now in the year 2000, which was divisible by 400, we did not shift the calendars because the Julian and the Gregorian calendar have a leap year because it was divisible by 400. But in the year 2100, it will happen again and another day will be added. So we've shifted roughly about an additional 3 days. Now Shmuel lives around the year 300, and in his time, the equinox on the Julian calendar was on September 24th. So since then, we've added roughly about 14 days difference between the Julian and Gregorian calendars. Therefore, you go out 14 days from there, it turns out to be October 7th. So now if you take October 7th and add 60 days from October 7th, it's going to fall out on December 5th and December 6th, depending if it's the year before leap year or the other years of this cycle. And that's why we say Tein Talamatar at that period of time. And we know that we have evidence from Machzorim before the year 1900 and after the year 1900 that those before 1900 said that the starting dates were December 3rd and 4th rather than what we have today as December 4th and 5th. And that's because 1900 was one of those years where the Gregorian calendar did not have a leap year, but the Julian calendar or Shmuel's calculation does have a leap year in it. And therefore that distinction or that difference causes it to shift over another day. And so we are following the original Julian calendar, the calculation of Shmuel. And because of that, we've now shifted from the equinox being where today is on September 22nd to where it's on October 7th for us. Clearly incorrect, but it's because we're following the sheet of Shmuel on the Julian calendar, which does not have an adjustment for the problem that over every 400 years, there's a 3-year skew between the solar calendar and the calendar Julian calendar or Shmuel's calendar. For that reason, every 100 years or so, it shifts another day forward. Now, this problem is not limited to just calculating the solar calendar, because Shmuel's calculation is also used to equal out in the 19-year cycle between the lunar calendar and the solar calendar. And for that reason, there's also a differential, which is not as big, between the 19-year cycle that we have that's starting to shift the holidays. That means that over time, there's a skew in the Hebrew calendar, meaning the lunar calendar, within the solar calendar. And that means that Pesach and Sukkot have been getting progressively later. All the holidays have been getting progressively later each 100 years or so because of the fact that we're using that solar basis of 365 and a quarter to determine what the lunar year is. There's also a slight differential between the synodic lunar month, which is the Molad, and that which Chazal quoted. That differential is much smaller than the differential between the solar calendar. But that differential also adds up over time. Adding both of those up over time is causing a shift in the calendar and not as pronounced or not as obvious as that which is happening with regards to Tein Talamatar, which is only based on the solar calendar where the differential between Shmuel and the Gregorian calendar is blatant and obvious. And that's why we're doing it 14 days later than we should, is because of that differential. But nevertheless, there is such a differential. It takes much more time and therefore it won't be as noticeable if the Chazal are correct in the opinions that think that the world only lasts for 6,000 years, it won't be so significant. But if it continues to go and the years continue to add up, then it will become a more significant thing. And then over tens of thousands of years, it would shift Pesach and Sukkot to the opposite seasons based on that. But again, we don't have to deal with that so far out. But just on a basis of having it be correct, there should may possibly be some investigation or look into the calendar to see if there is a way to solve the problem, which people have proposed solutions to the problem, which would keep all the rules of Moshe Michalacha, Moshe Mishinai intact, and keep almost all the holidays intact. 80% of them would overlap with what would have been in the 19-year cycle. And so there are solutions out there, but they need to be investigated, and there needs to be a will to deal with this issue of the problem. And I'm just mentioning it over here because it's a significant influence and obvious when it comes to this issue of Tein Tal Umotar Livracha. Okay, now we continue in the next Mishnah. If the 17th of Mar Cheshvan comes around and the rain is yet to come, so this is what we saw back in the Gemara on Daf Vav, that's what the third Riviyah was for, which is that if it doesn't rain by the third Riviyah, that's the trigger for starting to fast and to beseech Hashem for rain. And over here, that's what the Rishonim point out, that this Mishnah is obviously according to Rabbi Meir, who says that the 17th of Mar Cheshvan is the third Riviyah, and therefore that's what the trigger is. Therefore, according to us, should we pass like Rabbi Yehuda or pass like Rabbi Yossi, then the fasting wouldn't start until the 23rd or the 1st of Kislev. Although there are many Rishonim that suggest that because this is only Yechidim that are fasting, and since according to Rabbi Meir, you've already crossed into an area where you're past the three Riviot and you haven't had rain, so we start the fasting, even though this is not the main fasting will only start, as we'll see in later Mishnayot, with Rosh Chodesh Kislev, with the rest of the population and everybody fasting, and that'll be based on the fact that that's either Shita Rabbi Yossi, or because that's the latest time that someone has Riviyah, and therefore, even if we pass like Rabbi Yehuda, since Rabbi Yossi has a slightly later time, we wait for that in order to be sure that it's a dire situation, and therefore we start the fast for the main only on Rosh Chodesh Kislev. Over here, these are for the individuals, as we'll see. Maybe that starts earlier on the 17th of Cheshvan, even if we don't necessarily paskin like Rabbi Meir. So, lo yadu gshamim, itchila yechidim. The individuals, and we'll see in the Gemara what individuals are, these are people of stature, they are tamidei chachamim, leaders of the generation, people who can beseech Hashem on behalf of the nation. Mitanim gimel taniyot, they fast 3 fast days. Ochlim v'shotim echashecha, they can still eat and drink at nighttime. They're not 24-hour day fasts, rather daytime fasts. When they start, it's not clear whether they start at Lota Shachar later on in the Gemara. Rashi seems to indicate they start at Netzachama, at the sunrise, but we today practice that we start fast days at the break of dawn and not at sunrise. So that's when the fast begin. Mutarim b'melacha, there's no Isser melacha on them. Uberechitza, sikha v'nilata sandal, v'tashmish amita. They don't have the 5 inuim, which are associated with much more severe fasts, like Tisha B'Av, Yom HaKippurim, and we'll see later on, the 13 fasts of the Tzibur that are instituted for lack of rain, they progressively become more chamur. Eventually, they add on these 5 inuim. They don't apply to these first fasts, where it's only eating and drinking that's problematic, that one inui. The other 4 inuim of bathing, anointing, wearing shoes, and marital relations are not restricted. Once you reach Rosh Chodesh Kislev and there's no rain, baiting goes rim shlosh taniyot al tzibur. Then we bring in the whole Am and they start to fast then. Again, these first fast days are lighter fast days because we're only the beginning of the problem. We're hoping that the lighter fast days will solve the problem. Therefore, you can still eat and drink at night, meaning that the fast only starts in the morning. And again, malacha is permitted on those days. Those additional 4 inuim don't apply. They're not as severe fasts. Now, man yichidim. Who are the individuals that we're speaking about in the Mishnah? Rahuna, rabbonon. It's the tamidei chachamim, the rabbonon, the leaders of the generation. Ramuna, yichidim mitanim, shalosha taniyot. They fast 3 times. Sheni chamishi v'sheni. Starting Monday, Thursday, Monday, Bahab, they fast. Maikamashmalan. What is Rav Huna telling us that we don't already know? Tanina. It's a Mishnah later on in the Gemara that Engozim Tanina Tzibur b'tchila b'chamishi. You're not allowed to start a sequence of fasts on a Thursday. So you have to start on a Monday. Shalol Eftiyat Hasharim. In order not to break the marketplace. Breaking the marketplace, as Rashi says, is that the quantities go down, or in essence, there's inflation. It brings prices up. The way Rashi explains it over here is that there's going to be a run on the marketplaces because people are fasted, so they need a meal for post to fast on Thursday. Plus, they're preparing for Shabbat, so they're going to buy double. And the sellers are going to be unaware of the fact that there was a fast day. They're going to think that people think that there's a rav famine coming to the world, and they're going to raise the prices because of that. Now, that's the way Rashi explains it. Even if the sellers were aware of the fact, you could explain this, which is the sellers see that there's more demand than supply that's available, and that's forcing the prices up. It's going to cause the prices to rise. That's going to make it difficult on people, so we don't want to start on a Thursday because of the demand-supply imbalance, because it puts people in a position where they have to buy extra. That's the view of Rashi, or the alternative that we gave for Rashi. On the other hand, if you look in the Rabbeinu Gershom, he brings a different reason, which is that B'nai Kfarim, the people of the villages that come into the cities on Mondays and Thursdays to supply the food to the marketplaces, as we know from the Gemara and Megillah, that's a part of the discussion there with regards to reading the Megillah, and providing the shalach monot and the needs for the suda, that they come in on Monday and Thursday. So if they come in on a Thursday, and they suddenly find out that there was a fast day on Thursday, which they weren't aware of, they're not going to have sufficient supplies to meet the demand that's there. Since they don't have sufficient supplies to meet the demand, it's going to cause prices to rise. It's nothing to do with the famine, but just because there's not sufficient supply there. On the other hand, if they start on a Monday, then they'll buy for the Monday, but they'll be aware already that they started Monday, Thursday, Monday. They'll know by Thursday that people are going to be buying double, and so they should bring in extra supplies on Thursday to satisfy the demand for the post-to-fast, as well as on Friday itself. It's all interesting because if you fast on a day and then you make up for it by eating more on Thursday night, That's just the equivalent of eating on Thursday and just coalescing it into a single purchase on Thursday night, where you're buying for Thursday night and for Shabbat. So it all is a psychological thing, because people aren't eating more than they normally eat, but it has to do with the, whether it's the demand supply imbalance, like Rashi says, because the suppliers are unaware, or the way Rabbeinu Gershom says that the Bnei Kfarim don't bring in enough supply, whether it's just a psychological thing that the people have more demand at one single time and therefore the sellers are able to raise their prices, or because of the psychological impact that people eat more when they fasted, even though they would normally eat on Thursday and now they didn't eat, so they're going to eat on Thursday night. That what they make up for, they eat more than they normally would eat, and therefore there is a greater demand. And so all of those might cause a change in pricing. So we're going to avoid that. We start on a Monday, which gives people time to prepare for that issue of the upcoming Thursday and Friday. We're going to be buying for Shabbat and for the post to fast at the same time. So if that's already in place, and we know that from the Mishnah, so then what is Rav Huna adding for us that you have to do it on a Monday, Thursday, Monday? Ela shalosh taniyot rishonot, sheni v'chamishi v'sheni. We know that the first three ten fasts have to be on a Monday, Thursday, Monday. Ma'adu teimo, I would have thought, hanimilei tzibur. That's only when the greater community is fasting. V'yachid, when it's individuals that are fasting, maybe we won't have to start on a Monday, Thursday, Monday. We can start on Thursday because they're not going to affect the price in the market because they're not a large enough contingent. Kamash malon, that even in this situation, we only do Monday, Thursday, Monday. Even when it's a smaller subset of the community that's fasting, we only start on a Monday, we don't start on a Thursday. Tanya Nami Ochim, we have a bright that supports this contention. Nechidim begin to fast, they fast on a Monday, Thursday, Monday. And they suspend the fasts for Rosh Chodesh Kislev. Now, that is hard because if you're starting to fast on the 17th, it's very unlikely that it will fall down on Rosh Chodesh Kislev. There is a situation in which it could be that if the Yud Zayin falls out on a Thursday, then the Monday, Thursday, Monday, Monday will fall out on Rosh Chodesh Kislev. So there is a possibility of it falling out on Rosh Chodesh Kislev in that case. Maybe that's what they're talking about, suspending it for that Rosh Chodesh Kislev. Or it could be, this is a more generic statement about other fasts of the Tzibur, that if they have a sequence of fasts that are going to coincide or be co-located with Rosh Chodesh, that we suspend that series of fasts when it comes to Rosh Chodesh, as well as all the other holidays that are mentioned in Megillat Tanit. So this seems to be something that was either a bright or something that was said before Churban HaBayit, when Megillat Tanit was still extant. Or according to Rabbi Yochanan, who thinks that Megillat Tanit is still effective even after Churban HaBayit, and therefore these holidays will be impactful in terms of stopping the community from fasting, because that's the holidays in Megillat Tanit are holidays where you're not allowed to fast, and some of them are also holidays you can't give a eulogy, but fasting for sure is not allowed on those days, and therefore the sequence of fasts would be suspended on those days. So Tan Rabbanan, Ayumar Adam Tamid Ani, Eni Ro'i Liot Yachid. So here we have, within the hierarchy of society, we have different levels. We have people that are Tamidim, they have people Yachidim. The Mishnah says that the Yechidim are the ones that fast. So all of a sudden, all these Talmidim who are aspiring to be these Yechidim, they're going to say, you know what, I'm not a Yochid, I don't need to fast. So the Braita says, that's not the case. El kol Talmidei Chachamim Yechidim. Even Talmidim who are not Yechidim yet, they should classify themselves as Yechidim, and they should fast. So now Gemara wants to know, Ezu Yechid, Ezu Talmid. What's the difference between a Yechid and a Talmid? Yechid, Koshra Oin, Limnoto, Parnasa, Letzibur. So Yechid is pretty straightforward. It's someone who is Ro'oi to be a leader of the community, a leader of the generation. Someone who is already erudite enough and has enough experience that they are ready to be appointed as someone as a leader of the courts, leaders of the communities, leaders of the generation. So that's who are the Yechidim. Tamid, Skosha Sholim Oto Davar Alacha Bilimudo. Anytime you ask somebody in his learning, Vomera Filu Masechet Kala, and he's able to answer something even in Masechet Kala. The Rashi over here explains that Masechet Kala is one of the Masechtot HaKtanot. It's a braita that begins, Kala, B'li Bracha, is Asura L'Bala. Kala without Sheva Brachot is Asura L'Bala. And it's a braita that speaks about the issues of Kala and Sheva Brachot. And so Rashi says it's something that wasn't learned so often, and it was something that was a sidebar to the major learning or the primary learning. And so someone is called a Talmid, when you ask him halacha, and he can even answer you in one of these far-fetched places as Masechet Kala, he can still answer, which is pretty impressive. If that's a Talmid, then what's a Yochid? Meaning that sounds like something that is pretty impressive. They can answer any halachic question in any part of Shas, including Masechet Kotanot, that's a Talmid. But Yochid is something above that. And Tosfot already raises that issue over here, and he says, V'kasha, Where it sounds like a Talmid is someone who asks halacha anywhere in Shas, even in these small Masechtot, Bomran is able to answer it. And in Masechet Shabbat, it sounds like just the opposite. Who is the one that is right you to be a leader of the Tzibor? The definition they give here for a Talmid is the definition they give there for a panas. Therefore, Tosfot is bothered by how could this be the definition of a Talmid over here. Since the Yesh Lomar, the Yesh Chiluk, and this is somewhat relying on the Rabbeinu Chananel over here, and the Rabbeinu Gershom says, Afilu Masechet Kala, Shein Girigili Tasekbo, something that they didn't normally learn. It was something that was unusual or not a mainstream type of part of the learning. And the Rabbeinu Chananel says, Vafilu B'Masechet Kala, that all the Talmidei Chachamim that want to discuss it at the Kala is the Yarchei Kala, the twice a year, where all the Talmidei Chachamim got together to discuss the Lachot before the Chag of Pesach and before the Chag of Sukkot. So that's when they would discuss this Masechet, they would all prepare it in order to be ready to discuss it. Now, Tosafot explains, maybe incorporating what we just saw in the Rabbeinu Chananel and the Rabbeinu Gershom, Yishamar Deish Chiluk B'Talmid. They're different Talmidim. The Davka Sharav Ba Makom Echad, Chol Talmidim Etzlo Zeshuel Shel Rav Mimashehu Lomed. A Talmid asks the Rav, no matter where he's founding, meaning that the Rav is holding everywhere in Shas. So no matter where every Talmid is found in the Masechta, that Masechta you can ask the Rav and the Rav can answer, even though it's not what the Rav's learning right now. He Sholeit in Kol HaShas Kulo, and he can answer everything. So the Talmidim are someone who is learning a specific Masechta, and the Rav is someone who has control or erudition with regards to all the Masechtot, and he can answer all the Talmidim. That's a Rav, and that's a Talmid. And that, when the Gemara says, that's the definition of the Gemara in Shabbat, for someone who is a Talmid, Chacham is going to be a Parnas. Zehu Yachid, and Adif mi Talmid. That's what a definition of a Yachid is over here. Tahacha, Benikri Talmid Ahotam. And that's the Talmid over there. Talmud Chacham over there is considered to be someone who's ra'oi to be Parnasa Letzibur. Now, what about over here where it says that he is able to answer? So what it seems to be, what Tosfot is suggesting is, Ezu Talmid is, Kol Shesholim Oto Devar Alacha B'Limudo, if you ask him a question, what he's learning, Va'omer, and he answers it. Va'afilu B'Masechet Kala. Even if he's only learning Masechet Kala, and he's able to answer the questions on Masechet Kala, that's a classification of a Talmid. And so what Tosfot is suggesting is that this type of Talmid is a Talmid that's learning one Masechta, and he can answer questions in the Masechta that he's learning. Even if that Masechta is just a small Masechta like Masechet Kala, that's what the Rabbeinu Gershom suggests over here, it was something they didn't learn all the time. So according to Rashi, that's significant because he has far-reaching knowledge that reaches even to Masechet Kala. But according to Tosfot, even though it's not a well-learned Masechta, if that's what he learned, and he knows how to answer questions, then maybe he's already classified as a Talmid. According to Rabbeinu Chananel, this is things that they reviewed at the Kala when they got together. Everybody agreed to review a specific Masechta. So the Talmidim are the ones that are learning a specific Masechta and can discuss the Halacha with regards to that specific Masechta that they're discussing. That's already a Talmid. But someone who is Sholeit, B'chol HaShas Kulo, that's a Yochid that's mentioned over here, and the Talmud Chacham mentioned the Gemara in Shabbat, because they can answer questions in any Masechta, and that's someone who is Ra'oid L'Memento Aparnas HaLetzibur. Tanabanan, Lo Kol HaRotzeh LaSot Atzmo Yachid Oseh. We have a problem now because we have a bright that seems to indicate otherwise. That not anybody wants to make themselves into a Yachid, elevate themselves, can do that. Talmid Oseh. That not anybody wants to make themselves into something to a Talmid Chacham can do that. Tivi Rabbi Meir. That's Rabbi Meir. But you can't elevate yourself to be a Yachid. Or to act like a Talmid Chacham. Rabbi Yossi Omer Oseh B'Zachur L'Tov. So you can elevate yourself to a level of Yachid, because it's not something that is praiseworthy or beneficial to him. It's negative or it's pain that's caused to him. Meaning that when it comes to things that are matters of kavod and prestige, over there people can't step out of their bounds and assume themselves to be a Talmid. On the other hand, when it comes to things that are negative, meaning fasting and doing things that are not privileges, but rather seen as things that are obligations and burdens, that's something that's not Mechseh Yehura, it's not Gasuta Ruach to do such a thing, and therefore a person can put themselves in that category, and Zachor Letov, if they do such. And the Gemara in Masechet Pesachim, in Makom Shenagu, says the same thing with regards to not doing Melocha on Tisha B'Av, that Talmidei Chachamim don't do Melocha on Tisha B'Av. It says over there, anybody who wants to be Menahag, make himself into a Talmud Chacham, can do so, because over there, again, it's not a matter of Kavod and privilege and prestige, it's a matter of desisting from Melocha, and that's okay, because over there it doesn't look like Gasuta Ruach, similar to over here, where fasting doesn't look like Gasuta Ruach. So according to Rabbi Meir, you can't make yourself into a Yachid, if you're just a regular lay person. But if you're a Talmid, you can't elevate yourself to the level of a Yachid. Rabbi Yossi comes along and says, no, anybody who wants to elevate themselves to the level of a Yachid can do this because it's not a matter of prestige. That's the first way Rashi brings. When Rashi brings a Lishna Achrina, which is that Rabbi Meir is saying that a regular lay person can't make themselves into a Talmid or assume themselves to be a Yachid. And Rabbi Yossi comes to disagree with the Reisha part that says that regular lay person, he can elevate himself to the level of a Yachid. But a regular layperson can't elevate themselves to a Talmid. And the reason is because elevating yourself from the level of a regular layperson to a Talmid is involved in the way that you dress and conduct and the type of hat that you wear. And that's all matters of kavod, prestige, and gasuta ruach. So those you can't do by yourself or you can't accept upon yourself if you're not ra'ui for it. And from a Talmid going up to a Yachid, over there the real difference is in this obligation to fast. And that Rabbi Yossi says is fine, even though Rabbi Meir thinks it's not proper. Rabbi Yossi says that it is proper, and Rashi favors this second view or this second version of the explanation of the Braita, based on the upcoming Gemaras. The Tanya Yidach, we have another Braita. That's only when it's somebody positive. You can't do it. And it's a positive thing, and you should be blessed for that. Because it's not something that's prestigious. Something that's an obligation, and it's painful, and it's an undertaking for him, an obligation, and we're fine with that. And again, Rashi is saying here that he thinks that that refers to the lay people making themselves into yichidim, not lay people making themselves into talmidim. Someone was fasting for some problem, and then it passed. Or someone was sick, and then they were healed. You have to finish off the fast. So this is a little difficult, because the Gemara further on says that if the people became to fast for rain, and it rains, they stopped the fast, because they were successful, right? They got what they wanted. Question is, how do you reconcile that? The Gemara here, which seems to indicate that we do not allow you to interrupt the fast if you get what you wanted, and you have to continue fasting. And Rashi says it is because if he doesn't finish his fast, it looks like he's playing games with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. If the thing passed, I don't need to fast anymore, like the way of the Geshem, and therefore I don't need to fast. If it doesn't pass, then I will fast. That makes it sound exactly like the way that the other cases by the Geshem, which is that if the trouble passes, then you don't fast. And if the trouble continues, then you do fast. So then what's wrong? That makes the question even more pronounced over here. Why is this different than the Geshem? So the Rif over here and the Neil Ramban and the Rosh both answer over here that it's a chiluk between Tanit Rabim. We have a Tanit that is the Tzibur and the Tanit of a Yachid. For the Tanit of the Tzibur, there we don't want to be Matriach the Tzibur, and therefore we get answered, we stop the fast. On the other hand, when you have a Tanit of the individual, if they accept it to fast, they need to continue fasting because we will be Matriach on them. They can't play games here and pretend as if, oh, if God answers me, then I don't need to fast. No, the reason God answers you is because you were going to fast, and so you need to fast, nor that the answer of God is related to that what you did in order to facilitate or precipitate that generosity from a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And the Ritva, in making that distinction between the Tzibur and the Yachid, says that not only here do you have to fast when you have already started the fast and be mashlim, but if you already promised to do a series of fasts, and whatever bad or whatever issue has been cleared up, you still have to fast all those fasts that you promise in the future, which is not true when it comes to the Taniyot of the Tzibur, the Taniyot of Geshem, where because of the Tircha of the Tzibur, we would say, even if you've committed to fast in the future, we would suspend those fasts. On the other hand, the Ra'ah, it says that there might be a different distinction between this Gemara and the Gemara later on, and it's to when that happens, which is that the Gemara says later on, if they already fasted past Chatzot, then they have to finish the Tanit, even by Gshamim. And so the difference here might be that these are talking about situations in which you went already past Chatzot. Since you passed Chatzot, you have to finish off the fast, even if you get answered. And that's the same as true by Gshamim. If you find out earlier in the day, and it's before Chatzot, then you can break the fast, and you don't have to continue. And that might be the Lacho here as well, is what the Ra is saying. And he reconciles between the two, saying that they do have the same din. It's not a difference in Sibur and Yochid, but a difference in what time in the day you get the information, or that the resolution is comes about. Although, that explanation will not fit into the way that somebody like the Sfat Emet explained the Gemara over here, which is that the Gemara says over here, Harizeh mitaneh umashlim. And he says mitaneh means that if he promised to fast and he has yet to fast, he has to fast. Umashlim is if he's already fasting, he has to finish off the fast. So according to the Sfat Emet, the Gemara over here is suggesting that even if you haven't started fasting, you have to fast. And there, that wouldn't work out according to the distinction that the Ra'ah is making over here. And it's pretty clear that the Rambam doesn't accept it as well, because the Rambam just writes Mashlim, never writes Mitaneh. which according to the Sfatim Eb would mean that the Rambam thinks that you only have to finish off a fast, you don't actually have to start a fast that you promised to do in the future. The third possibility of how to answer or reconcile between this and the situation of the rain is the Ran brings in the name of the Raivud, that by Tanit Kishamim, when the rain falls, the problem has been solved. Meaning that the problem was that was a lack of rain. When it rains and it starts to rain, it's going to continue raining. And therefore the problem is solved, and there's no reason to continue fasting because the tzara has passed. Now then, even when someone is sick and they've been cured, we're not sure that they're completely cured. We're not sure that they have to go into remission, that they'll become sick again and have a relapse. And the same with other tzarot, where it's not clear that the tzara has passed, therefore you have to continue fasting. And that would then raise a possible nafkamina that was different than what Rashi says. Rashi says over here that you have to fast even if the whole chole successfully recovers, or if the chole dies. You have to continue the fast because you already promised to fast. But according to the way the Ran is suggesting, that's not true. If the chole passes away, then you won't have to continue the fast because the tzara, quote-unquote, is gone. There's no purpose in the fast anymore. On the other hand, if he's sick and he recovers from that sickness, that we don't know if there's a full recovery, and then you would have to continue fasting. That would be a nafkamina between these reasonings, whether you would have to continue fasting when the chole passes away, where Rashi says you do. According to the Ran, it would sound like you do not have to do that. Now Gemara continues in the Braita, Olech mimakom shei mitanim, mimakom shmitanim. It goes from a place where they're not fasting to a place where they are fasting. He has to fast with them. If he was in a place where they were fasting, he goes to a place where they're not fasting. He has to finish his fast. This is based on the Gemara in Makom Shenagu. He has the chumra to the place that he left, and the chumra to the place where he's going to. And Tosfot over here says, lo shna. It does not have the qualification, the Gemara in Makom Shenagu, of Dato Lachzor. If you intend to return to the place, if you left the place that wasn't fasting, and you're going to come back there, doesn't matter. If you end up in a place where they're fasting, you need to fast with them, because you are mekabel on yourself the tanit, or by definition, going to that place is a kabbalat tanit, because you are a member of the tzibur, and being a member of the tzibur, you can't separate yourself out from the tzibur, and you have to fast along with the tzibur. Shachach, vachal v'shata. If a person made a mistake, and he didn't realize, sounds like this is a different case totally. I mean, it's not a continuation of the previous case where he went to a place where they were fasting and he wasn't fasting and now he has to fast. So if it was a continuation of that, it would sound from this, can't publicly eat, but in private you could eat. And therefore, shachach v'chal v'shata, ha'yitzareh b'fnei tzibur. And therefore, if you've got to eat, don't do it in front of other people if you forget to, and you do eat. Because you can only do this in quiet or in private. And Sfat Amer, who says that's only true if he forgot to be mekabel l'tanit, or he showed up in the middle of the day. If he's mekabel tanit and he forgot about the tanit, there for sure if he eats, he has to continue fasting, and that's based on a principle that Gemara has in Sanhedrin, Misha chal shum v'rechol nodef. Somebody ate garlic and his breath stinks. Yachzor v'yachol shum, he should continue eating garlic. If just because you did something wrong, you don't tell you to continue to do something wrong, and you have to continue fasting and finish off the fast. That's if you read it as a continuation. The more likely way to read it is that this is a new statement, which is a person's on a fast day, and they made a mistake after they were fasting and they start to eat and drink, don't make yourself in front of the tzibur be apparent that you've eaten and that you've satisfied yourself or that you no longer are in the pain of fasting, because that's not the right thing to do. That's almost like poking fun at other people, and you're doing it because you did something wrong. It's almost you're gloating that which you did wrong by doing that. And a person should then not pamper themselves. And that's the meaning of al yinhagi dinuim batzmo. If you made a mistake and eat, don't continue eating until you're satisfied. That's what the Braita means. That when you make that mistake, don't continue with that mistake to satisfy yourself. You made the mistake, stop right away, and then continue with your fast. Shinemar, Vayomer Yaakov Levanav, Lama Titra'u. So Yaakov says to his children, why are you peering in this way? He heard that there's grain in Mitzrayim, why aren't you going down to purchase those grains? Rashi says the Pashtut of here is Lama Titra'u. Why should you appear like you have no need to buy food? And that might be because you are foolish and you need to go buy food. Why are you making it like you're not? Or why is it that you are appearing to not need food because you have plenty here, but you don't want other people to know that you have plenty over here? Or the other possibility the Ramban suggests over here, Lama Titro, is why can people still find you in this location? You should have already gone down to Mitzrayim to buy food before we run out of food over here. And that maybe is the Pashtut of Lama Titro. The Ramban al Torah says that Esav and Ishmael did not live in Eretz Canaan at that time. Therefore, he's surprised that Rashi, who brings Chazal down, is saying that it's lo b'fnei Esav and lo b'fnei Ishmael. Truth is that the Ramban's question is not just on Rashi, it's on the Midrash that we're learning here right now. And he tries to answer that maybe they also had a famine, and they had to pass through Eretz Canaan on the way to Eretz Mitzrayim, and therefore they would notice the status, what was going on with Bnei Yaakov. That's why Yaakov is explaining that to them. Or the other possibility is that kinah or jealousy is only really apparent or meaningful when you're dealing with people who are close, like brothers. When people are foreigners and have nothing to do with each other, then being jealous of them is not really a relevant thing because you don't have any shaykhut to them. You're not in the same category as them. Therefore, it's only Bnei Esav and Bnei Yishmael who are family to Bnei Yaakov. They're the ones who are going to have kinah. And that's what he says, shalok yitkanu bachem, so that they should not be jealous of you. The Gemara, on the other hand, says, Amalem Yaakov levanav, al tiru atzmechem, kshatem sveim, lo bifnei Esav, lo bifnei Yishmael. Don't make yourselves look like you're satisfied. We have plenty of food. But don't make it look like you have plenty of food in front of those that are starving, like Bnei Yishmael and Bnei Esav. You should pretend like you don't have like they do, so that they don't think that you have lots of produce and lots of food, because either they'll come, they'll try to friendly or not friendly way, they'll try to take it from you, or because it's not the right way to act. When other people are suffering, you shouldn't be acting in a manner that flaunts the fact that you're not suffering the same difficulties that they are, and therefore you should be a part and parcel of the Tzara Tzibur, or the Tzara of the general public. So now that the Gemara is already darshaning about the brothers going down to Yosef to buy food, they say when Yosef reveals himself to them and then sends them back, he says to them, Al tigrzu b'darach, don't tarry or get angry on the way. The Pashtuta Pasuk is probably speaking about the fact that they shouldn't blame each other or get into a fight about who sold Yosef down or who caused this problem over here. The Gemara Darshan says, "Ravelazar, Malahem, Yosef lechav al titasku bedvar halacha. Don't be involved in halachic topics. Shema tigrzu alechem aderech, because maybe the way will become difficult for you. One way to learn that tigrzu aderech means that you'll get lost. You won't be paying attention, and then you'll get mad at the way because you lost your way because you were involved in the halacha. That's one possibility. Another possibility is Rabbeinu Gershom suggests over here, Shoret chem tem chokim bedvar halacha." People see you fighting about issues of halacha, they'll think that you're at war or you're having a fight, mitragzim aleichem, and they get upset at you that you're fighting. And so that outside people will see you doing this, and that's going to be the problem. Doswell brings a midrash that says just the opposite, al tuzub ederech, yesh midrash, al tafsiku mit devar halacha. Don't stop talking about devar halacha. That's clearly not the way that our Gemara is reading, and we'll see from the subsequent part that that's the case. Gemara says, "Ini, is that really true?" V'amar Rabbi Elai Berechia, Shnei Tamid Chachamim Shalachim Baderech. You have two Tamid Chachamim that are traveling together. V'ei Medem Divrei Torah Ruim Listeref. That if they don't talk in Torah, they should be burnt up. Shneimar V'hi Heima Ochim. Because it says about Elisha and Eliyahu when Eliyahu was about to go up to the Shemayim. So V'hi Heima Ochim Holech V'daber. Then there was a fiery chariot and horses that separated between them and takes Eliyahu up to Shemayim. And the assumption is over here is Taima Deika Dibur. It's because they were Holech V'daber, they were walking and talking, that Dibur saved him. Haleka Dibur, had there not been talking between them of Halacha, Ru'im Lisareif, then he should have been burnt and Elisha should have been consumed by the fire that took Eliyahu up to Shemayim. Tosafot brings, again, an opposite view over here. Sheyesh midrashim ayud midabrim dvarim b'teilim. That they actually were not speaking halacha, mushim hachi ruim lisareif. And they were roi to be nisraf, and that's why it happened with a fire, to indicate that they should have been burnt up with fire. But again, our Gemara seems to be indicating the other way around, that since they were discussing halacha, it protected them from the fire. Because it says, haloch vidaber. Lokash, so that's not a problem. Hal migros, hal yune. It depends what you're discussing. If it's a superficial type of discussion or a light chazara, that's fine. Because then, alal tigazu adarech, you won't lose your way because you'll still be paying attention. According to Rabbeinu Gershom, you won't get into a deep discussion or fight which will bother other people. And according to the midrash we brought over here, it'll provide you the protection that you need because you're learning. Haliune, if you're going to get into a deep, deep discussion, deep halacha, that's going to cause you to lose your way. That's going to cause you to get angry because you lost yourself in your learning and therefore you're not going to get to your destination on time. Or in Rabbeinu Gershom, it's going to cause you to have altercations between you that other people are going to witness and not think positively about. And therefore it's not appropriate, even though the Divrei Torah protect you. And the Magen Avraham says, based on this Gemara, that if you're sitting in a wagon or a chariot or on a boat, then it should be fine in order to do Iyun because it's not going to affect all these things that we're talking about over here, except for the Rabbeinu Gershom. Never would be permissible. And the other thing is possible is that Yosef was saying to his brothers, do not tarry because I need you to go back to my father and tell my father that I'm alive and bring him down here. And therefore, tigrzu b'darach means that you're going to get occupied with your learning and slow you down. So don't get slowed down. Do it as fast as possible. So if you're just doing light learning, you can keep moving and keep the pace up. And then iune, which is going to cause them to stop and either get lost or bogged down on the way, and that's going to slow them down. And that might be the explanation for the next part of the Gemara, which is Mantita Tana Altaf Siu Psia Gasa. The Braita, we said that he was telling them, don't take large, wide steps. Ve'ichnisu Chamadair, and you should enter the city while it's still light out. Altif Siu Psia Gasa, don't take large strides. Tamar Psia Gasa, no tell it, Achad Mechar Shmeot, Mimore Nav Shaladam. And when a person takes large strides, it takes away 1/500th of his eyesight. And it's interesting over here that Mekher Nora says it's a midah keneged midah, because lo taturach harei lebavchem acharei neichem, a person who wants to chase after his eyes runs to do what his eyes see, and therefore when he runs and does the long stride for the wrong things, then it takes away achad mechash meot mimor enav, takes away 1/500th of the eyesight of the individual. Tosfot over here discusses the problem of if it takes 1/500th, then every 500 steps, he's not going to have any eyesight left. So he answers the way that the Gemara answers other places when it gives a fraction like this, that it's asymptotic, which is that first you take 1/500th of his total eyesight, the next time he's going to take 1/500th of the 499 that are left, and therefore it keeps diminishing the fraction. So Tosfos says, why should that be the case? Why should the first step have more impact than the latter steps? So Tosfos gives two possibilities. It says, Eli Yish Lomar, Delono Tele Lepsia Rishona Davka, that maybe only a 1/500th comes off on the first step on the large stride, but afterwards it doesn't affect you because came into dash. Once you're already taking long strides, once you started, that's it. You already lost 1/500th. It's not continuous. Or he says, inami psia rishona nutel tfei. The earlier steps are more impactful because kolat chalot kashot. When you start something or you do something in the beginning, it has more impact. As you get more used to it, it has less impact. And similarly over here, the beginning, it has more impact on your eyesight. Later on, it has less impact on your eyesight. The Gemara in Shabbat notes that one can return this Me'orinayim by Kiddush and Abdullah. And so the Keren Ora says there again, it's a Midah Keneged Midah. Because Shabbat is resting and stopping from going Psia Gasa. So that's the rectification of that which you did wrong by doing the Psia Gasa. And the Halacha, the Ramah says, that Beshat Kiddush means that when you're making the bracha on the wine, when you're making Kiddush, you should look at the Knerot Shabbat. That's what Magzira Morei Nav. And then afterwards look in the kos. Other Rishonim like Rashi and the Ran say that's the drinking of the kos of Kiddush that brings the refuah. And Retour cites the fact that maybe putting the wine of Kiddush into your eyes or Abdullah into your eyes is what brings about that cure. The second thing that he told them was that they should only enter into the city when it was still light out. So both of these issues are things that when Yosef asked them to hurry up and to get back to his father quickly, they would have thought maybe they should do these things, which is do a psia gasa, or maybe travel at night, even though that's not the normal way to do things because they were in a rush. And so what Yosef is saying to them, even though you know that these halachot apply, they still apply here. Even when I'm telling you to, I want you to go back to my father quickly, I still think that these issues are issues that you should be careful about. And that is the other one is v'chnisu chama de'ir, should go into the city while it's still light. Could review the Marav. They quote from the Gemara in Psachim and the Gemara in Bava Kamma. Lolam yetzei adam b'chitov. A person would leave at a good time. Yikanes b'chitov and would come back into the city at a good time. Shnemar, the pasuk that they bring is a book or vaneshim shulchu. So that regards to the brothers, it says when the morning broke and they were sent on their way. I mean that only after light, it came light out, did they send them on their way.
And even though the pasuk really is only discussing when they leave the city, it should be light out. But the extrapolation is that should apply even when they enter the city. Or Rashi simply has a possibility that there's no girsa of this pasuk here at all, and it's a logical argument that Rav Yehuda is making.
Now, ki tov, as Rashi points out, comes from the Maaseh Bereishit, where it says, Vayar Elokim et or ki tov. So ki tov is a nice way to reference to or to light, as opposed to darkness. Rashi over here brings two possibilities as to what the reason is. One is protection from listim, Mitsuyin, that at nighttime marauders and robbers are out there, so it's dangerous and you shouldn't be going at nighttime. The other one is inami shloipol beborot bekayim shibeir, so the person shouldn't fall or not be able to see where he's going and fall into these pits and other things. And then people will be suspicious that they're coming at night and getting falling to these things on the way into the city. They'll think that they're spies or that they're coming to rob the city, and then they'll punish them or cause them problems. So it's not good to travel at night, both because of the dangers out there, the possibility that people will incriminate you for things that you are not trying to do, as well as the possibility that this means that only during the sunlight, because it's the aura of the sunlight and not the aura of the moon, so even if the moon gives light, it's still better to get into the city while there's still sunlight out, because that's kitov. Maybe that's part of the puzzle here, which is that low aura is tov, therefore the trip to have the blessing of tov, which should be done during the time of the light. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Rabbi Chiya, Amaleich B'derech, Ayuchel Yotar Mishtenei Ra'avon. person who's going on the way, setting out on a trip, he shouldn't eat more than he would eat during a time of famine. My time, huh? So what's the reasoning for that? Haki targimu mishum maino. So one reason that's brought is because of maino. Rashi over here says, shelo yitchal chulu me'av shel adam, so they should not become like liquefied, which refers to that stomach ache or weakness, what the Gemara ascribes to Esther batit chal chal hamalka me'od, that she was weakened by it or she was worried by it. Tosfot over here says, perish mishum shebnei ma'ayin havi kashe luhu, that it's going to give you some sort of stomach ailment. And the Rabbeinu Chananel says, Mishumayna, Perish, Im Yochal Harbe, Yikacheu Shulshul, Ve'evol Yitachem in Hashayra. If you eat too much, it's going to cause you to be Mishalshel, to be like a laxative, and therefore you're going to have to go to the bathroom, and you're going to miss the caravan that's leaving. Or the way the Rabbeinu Gershom says is, Shimochel Harbe, if he eats too much, Mitkabed Be'imeyav, it weighs him down in his stomach, it's going to slow him down, and he won't be able to keep up the pace with the remainder of the group. But you may run out of food if the trip goes longer than you think, so you should ration your rations so that you have enough for the whole trip. My binayu, what's enough community between them? You can binayu di'ayid ba'arba, sitting in a boat. So over there it doesn't shake around his stomach and you don't have all these stomach ailments, although you might get seasick, but therefore it's not an issue. Whereas with regards to the trip and the need for extra provisions, that still may be an issue. Or a place where you're going to go from place to place where you're going to have food supply along the way. And so therefore, it's not a worry about food supply, but still the stomach ailments are an issue. And every parson used to hold a loaf of bread. And we know from other places in Shas that Rav Papa was a very heavy individual. He thinks that the problem of eating too much is because of the stomach ailments. And he, because of his size, because of his ability to consume large amounts of food, didn't feel that that would be an issue for him. Okay, we're going to stop here, three lines down on the top of Yud Aleph Amud Aleph.